Sky News Centre at 5. The family of a man who tried to travel to Syria to fight for IS have been praised by a judge after they convinced him to return home. Last month, Adnan Mahmoud from Blackburn was convicted of preparing terrorism acts after travelling to Turkey, but his brother messaged him online and he came back to the UK. The 19-year-old has been jailed for 4 years. His lawyer, Zabir Afzal, says the family were hoping prison could have been avoided.
They were hoping it would not be necessary for the police to prosecute him. But the family recognised that the police officers have a difficult balancing act to do.
A man's been shot and killed in North London during what police are calling an intelligence-led operation. It happened close to Wood Green Crown Court this morning. Four other men have been arrested on suspicion of trying to help someone escape from custody. Nick Lindsay was working on the street nearby when armed officers arrived.
Police cars rushing down, police jumping out, shouting to move, get down, a smashing noise. The gunshot went off and then obviously wheels all moved.
Spain's Prime Minister has confirmed there's been an attack on the Spanish embassy in Afghanistan. Witnesses say there was a car bomb explosion outside a nearby guest house in Kabul before gunfire then started. A man's been jailed for sleeping with two women and not telling them he was HIV positive. The 46-year-old from Bristol is only the third person to be convicted of this type of offence. A Dutchman who set up a bogus ambulance firm to smuggle heroin and cocaine into the UK has been jailed for 24 years. Olaf Schoen, who's 38, previously pleaded guilty to conspiring to sneak over £1 billion worth of Class A drugs in through Harwich and Hull using specially adapted ambulances. His right-hand man was jailed for 28 years after being convicted by a jury. And Taylor Swift is trying to trademark the word Swiftmas. It's a term that she's used to describe her random acts of kindness for fans. That's the latest from the Sky News Centre. I'm Charlie Maggs.
BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
It's Friday, folks. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news was supposed to be Tory group leader Mark Weston. I was rather looking forward to that. But he's lost his voice today and can't find a last-minute replacement. So, old Labour Oxford economist. And I will be taking you through the news review in the first hour. After the 6 o'clock news, we collect together some experts on the Middle East and the war on terrorism this evening to untangle the web of this Syria bombing campaign without clear priorities or long-term military plan. Britain's alliance with the so-called moderate jihadis, which threatens to turn Syria into another Libya or Iraq. And as we go into the festive season with the bloody Paris attacks fresh in our memory, with only the police and press's word for who really carried out them, we ask, are we entering a new era where terror attacks like 9/11, 7/7 and Paris begin to happen so fast and furious that everyone's dead, so there are no proper trials and nobody has time to question police and TV reports before it's time for the next one? Where ignoring international law on our behalf just creates more recruits to the extremist causes. And have the jihadis got a point? Are our own corporations, banks and governments becoming so despotic they pose a danger to humanity? Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 Celsius and wet and windy, especially in the early hours. This weekend, highs of 14, pretty mild, isn't it? Mainly cloudy and mild weekend with some breezy conditions. Next week, highs of 14 again, mainly cloudy and breezy with some showers and sunny spells. Next weekend, 19th and 20th of December, highs of 14 Celsius, mainly cloudy with some showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. bbc.com. So, helping us review this week's news is supposed to be Mark Weston, but I'm afraid he's lost his voice today. So it's just Martin Summers and I will be taking you through the news review. First of all, Martin, what do you make of our first story we've got here? Because this is what I really wanted to talk to Mark about, which is the Tatler-Tory scandal. Been doing a little bit of research into this week. It first broke, I think, in the Daily Mail, but a lot of people have been looking at this. It's caught about this guy, Mark Clark, who's dubbed the Tatler-Tory, and he used revenge porn to threaten the 19-year-old Tory activist and demand to pay £2,500. The pornographic video contained footage of the victim performing a sex act which had allegedly been tricked into doing. And then he refused to pay the money, and as a result, the video was shared online, and it was there's all sorts of discussion about this, but very little discussion in the mainstream, particularly in broadcast press, about the sexual aspects to this. Sounds like a kind of sexual bullying thing.
Well, it does, doesn't it? But I think in all of these cases, I'm going to be rather boring and say, well, it's being investigated. There are criminal offences potentially here. And if there have been bullying and sexual bullying going on in the Tory party or anywhere else, then I would hope that it is dealt with firmly as it should be.
Apparently, at least 20 women have complained to the Conservative Central Office about Mark Clark, according to the Mail Online. In a letter to the party's chairman, Lord Feldman, one woman claimed the married father of two sexually assaulted her, threatened her when she complained, and snorted cocaine at party events.
Well, if you ask me, am I surprised at these kind of allegations? The answer is no, I'm not. Are they entirely accurate? Well, we're not entirely sure because they've not been properly investigated. They should be, and if any wrongdoing is uncovered, then those concerned should pay the price.
Well, Mark Clark allegedly also used the motto, isolate, inebriate, penetrate, to sleep with at least six female colleagues. Last week, female Tory aide to Prime Minister David Cameron, anti-porn advisor, was forced to quit after her role after it emerged she had had sex with Clark on a pub pool table.
Well, it's all very salacious stuff, isn't it? And which is why the Daily Mail has published it. No doubt sells newspapers. Am I surprised?
Does it surprise me
that this kind of culture exists? Not really.
Over the last decade, apparently, Lord Feldman, party chairman, had been being told about this guy, and yet he's now said he's got no recollection of any kind of complaints about him at all.
Well, it's quite clear that you might argue there's no smoke without fire. It's more than likely something has been going on that needs investigation. But when you've got specific allegations like this, it's unwise to make political capital out of it. I'm sure that the Tory party, like any other organisation in which power is diffused and manipulated, is open to being abused. Am I surprised about that? We all know about the culture of the Bullingdon Club back in the day, and this all sounds consistent with that, doesn't it?
Mark Clark's also accused of bullying Tory activist Elliot Johnson, who committed suicide, and that's really how this first reached the public eye, because his family were particularly annoyed about the fact that the Conservative Party had done nothing about it, despite having been a whole sheaf of complaints sent to them about Mark Clark.
Well, the problem for the Tory party is that if these allegations are eventually proved to be true, and they knew about them 5 years ago and took no action, then the Tory party itself is in the firing line, isn't it? Because you then get the question mark hanging over them. You should have done something and you didn't, in order to try and protect your reputation. Now, if you try and protect your reputation by covering things up and eventually you are found out, that in fact compounds the fault that you've committed. And the idea that there is a kind of bullying culture inside the Tory full-time machine wouldn't surprise me if it were true. And if it is true, people need to be punished. But let's be clear here, these are allegations. Very rather sensational allegations, the sort of allegations that sell newspapers, and they may or may not turn out to be fully vindicated.
The accused, Mark Clark, is currently residing in a £1,000 a night hotel in Barbados with his wife and two children. It's emerged since the Conservative chiefs investigating the scandal received a complaint from a 22-year-old activist who claimed she woke up naked in a Tory MP's bed with no memory of the night before. All she remembers is that she woke up naked and doesn't remember getting undressed, the source told The Telegraph. I mean, that's a kind of compilation of what's been going on here, allegedly. What bothers me is that a lot of this hasn't really been discussed. It's almost as if people are afraid to, even though statements have been made to the press, to actually pull together the sexual nature of this, possibly because this is not what the Tories want right now.
Well, you may say that, but it's the source of all of the allegations that we're looking at here is the Daily Mail. So it's almost like a family quarrel.
And the Telegraph.
Well, the Mail and the Telegraph are both Tory newspapers, and they're the ones who are covering these allegations. Therefore, we could presume, in actual fact, that they've got no particular axe to grind here, being Tory newspapers, and therefore it's more likely that they've come that the allegations are correct.
Now,
but on the other hand, they are sensational allegations. People like reading this sort of stuff, and editors know that, and therefore that's why they publish it.
They don't seem to like broadcasting it for whatever reason. But, I mean, we've talked quite a lot on this show, Martin, about the VIP pedophile scandal.
Indeed.
Where these kinds of sexual honey traps, that kind of thing, have been used, certainly we believe, for political blackmail. So does this, do you think, in any way dovetail with that?
Not really. I think the VIP pedophile scandal is much, much more serious, because the fundamental allegation is that people like Heyman, who was deputy director of MI6... were fingered as VIP pedophiles many years ago, and it was covered up. Not only was it covered up, but things like the Kincorra Boys Home scandal in Northern Ireland, evidence points to the fact that the intelligence services, MI5 and MI6, have used paedophilia as a means of blackmailing various targets. That is a very, very serious allegation. We're not just talking about sexual misbehaviour.
We're talking about allegations here with the Tatlatoria are also to do with blackmail.
Yes, but it's blackmail on it's personal power building, empire building by middle management, if you like. The VIP pedophile scandal goes much more to the heart of the matter, because it seems that there has been a continuous practice going back decades of using paedophile activities as a means of blackmailing targets, political targets. And in the Kincorra Boys Home, for example, which has been, you know, there's been lots of allegations about that for many years in Northern Ireland. It's the original allegation was that loyalist paramilitary leaders were being compromised by going to Kincorra, having sex with underage boys, and it all being videoed and then used to blackmail them. But subsequently, it's come out that it wasn't just loyalist paramilitary leaders who were having sex with underage boys and being blackmailed. And also, the suggestion is that it's not just Kincorra in Northern Ireland where this has been going on, and that there is, in fact, a culture of paedophilia and blackmail in MI5 and MI6. And I think the evidence for that is much stronger than anything we know about what happened with the Tatlatori here.
It sounds pretty sordid at the top of the political system anyway. I think, you know, the further down that you get, you start to reach and speak to, as we do here, you know, more ordinary people. But when it comes to controlling a political party, lots at stake, isn't it?
It is. I mean, paedophilia is obviously a problem, and sexual abuse of children is a problem in society in general. But if you've got a situation where agents of the state, particularly the intelligence services, are deliberately encouraging paedophile activity as a means of blackmailing various targets that they have, then that is illegal activity being carried out by the state, which you pay for out there, taxpayers. You're paying for that.
Well, we've heard again this week, haven't we, that Lord Jenner is too ill to stand trial. I was reminded of the Ernest Saunders trial in the 1990s, where he was let off from share dealing, insider dealing, to do with the Guinness scandal, because he had Alzheimer's, and yet then afterwards, later on in the 1990s, he made a miraculous recovery from Alzheimer's.
Well, indeed, and the real problem here is that if various politicians, Lord Jenner, for example, are being blackmailed by MI6 because of their previous paedophile activities, then that means that when Lord Jenner, for example, votes in favour of war in Iraq, that may not be an independent opinion that he's independently expressing. He may have been told what to do by the people who are basically handling him. That's the danger.
On to another story. Staying with the Tory party, a Conservative MP, Lucy Allen, defends taking a death threat over Syria faking a death threat over Syria airstrikes vote. Conservative MP said she faked a Syria death threat to show an example of the abuse that MPs receive. Lucy Allen, Conservative MP for Telford, admitted misrepresenting an email from a member of one of her constituents, a member of the public. She put added an edited comment, added the line "unless you die" to the end of it to turn it into a death threat, rather than actually put the comment which was posted on there. The person who posted it, Adam Watling, who's 27, emailed Lucy Allen, Conservative MP for Telford, asking her to vote against the Syrian airstrikes under his online pseudonym Rusty. However, Adam, who works in audio production, was left stunned when Lucy posted his email on her Facebook page, including three extra words at the end of it. Three crucial extra words. So, Martin, they are crucial, aren't they? Because "unless you die" rather changes the meaning of it. And this is a constituent of hers, and one wonders if any constituents could ever trust this accountant turn MP again.
Well, I mean, this is a much more open and shut case, because Tory MP Lucy Allen has admitted that she's faked this death threat in an email to her. If I was running the Tory party, I would expect her to resign, frankly, for something like that. There's no ifs, no buts, no doubts about this. Completely wrong. She is essentially, she's abusing her position, and also potentially creating problems for the constituent who's in good faith emailed her to put his opinions to her. He was using a pseudonym, but we now know who he is. He could sue her for libel. Because he didn't make a death threat. And a death threat is, in fact, a criminal offence. So he has been made to look as if he carried out a criminal offence by an MP.
But he was using a pseudonym, so there may be, you know, I don't know if that would be...
Well, I think in any case, you could argue that... forging a death threat, I would argue that's almost as serious as making a death threat. And ought to be treated by the police in a similar way. Perhaps the police ought to be interviewing Lucy Allen to say, hang on a minute, you have faked a death threat. We get people making death threats all the time, and you have faked one. You are at minimum wasting police time. At maximum, we could argue that you've committed a criminal offence here.
But I think I'm right in saying she only became an MP in May. I would imagine many of her constituents will be thinking twice before contacting her and whether they can trust her or not.
Well, there's a political price to pay for these things, as there should be. But I would argue that in actual fact, there may be a criminal case here. Quite straightforward. You're not supposed to go around making stuff up like that.
On to local story. Stop the war. Hundreds take over Bristol city centre for a second protest against the airstrikes. This is in the Bristol Post Thursday, I think, probably posted up there Wednesday evening. Hundreds of people took to the streets in the city centre to protest the airstrikes on Syria on Wednesday evening, organised by a 16-year-old girl from a local sixth form. The message about the march and rally was spread across social media. More than 500 people marched from the Fountain, St Augustine Parade, up Park Street, around the Triangle and back down to College Green. Roads were not closed. Traffic ground to a halt at certain points. Ruby Howardson Hill, who's a pupil at St Mary Redcliffe and Temple School, was moved to act after MPs voted in favour of renewed airstrikes on Syria.
Well, I think this is an extremely commendable initiative by these young people. I went to the demonstration, and it was very well attended, as the Bristol Post has pointed out. Most of the people there were the same age as Ruby, 16, 17. But there were some oldsters there like me as well, and you as well also, Tony, I understand.
Oh, Martin, you're introducing me here, because, yes, of course, I was down there, and I just thought, because it was organised by young people, it would be interesting to go around and have a chat to some old and young and see what views were there to be expressed, especially when you've got nearly, whatever it is, 500,000 people have decided to come together over this cause. Let's have a listen now for a few minutes to some of the views that I collected when I was down at the Stop the War march, organised by Ruby Howardson Hill and her friends from St Mary Redcliffe and Temple School.
I'm Zoe. I'm doing college at the moment. So many innocent people are going to die, so what's the point? Surely there's a better way of doing this.
I'm Nuha, as I'm against the bombing in Syria. I feel like it's a bit contradictory how they say they're bombing to protect British people, but so many Syrian people are going to be killed because of the bombs. So I feel like whose lives are worth more in this case? I feel like the general consensus around the country that doesn't reflect the vote that's been carried out in Parliament.
I'm Amy and I don't agree with it, because at the end of the day, they should ask the public, not just set out as the people in the parliament, but the public, the UK, because we are now labelled as what has been going around social media as murderers, and it is not right, it is not fair on us to be labelled as that. It's a protest, so it gets the point across. There are many, many, many people here, and it gets the point across. So I think it's right to all come here and to support what we believe in and to try and get peace.
How would you actually achieve that, though? Because the Commons has now voted to bomb Syria, so you can't really reverse that, can you?
No, but we all have our opinion, and it is not right that we are now labelled as something we're not without our consent as the UK.
I'm Ella, and I'm here because I think that what the government has decided is disgusting, and I think that we should make a stand to try and like show that we're not with them, and that maybe they could change their views. Bombing innocent Syrian people is not going to stop ISIS. They're not just based in Syria; they're all over the world. They communicate without having to kill loads of people. They're saying stop killing people, but then they're killing other people to try and fight that, which is like not going to work.
I'm Courtney, and I just don't agree with bombing Syria. I think them, like, bombing or attacking us shouldn't just be retaliated with. I don't think that's going to equal peace in any way, shape or form. Like, we don't want this. They're just kind of deciding it on their own and thinking, yeah, let's just do that. No, we don't want this.
I'm Johnny, and I'm here because I'm against imperialist intervention in the Middle East. Well, bombing Syria, I don't believe, is meant to really defeat ISIS. I think it's meant to just create more instability for Western governments to take advantage of the Middle East. There's no evidence that these bombing raids will weaken ISIS. In fact, there's a strong suggestion it will do the opposite. The United States and other countries have been bombing ISIS in Syria for a long time, and it doesn't seem to be making any progress at all. The only forces that seem to be making any progress are actually the Kurds, who aren't bombing. They're fighting on the ground. More dead civilians and more refugees trying to get into Europe, and a worsening refugee crisis.
My name's Becky. I'm here because I just find it horrifying what's going on in Syria, and I don't think they need any more people attacking and just not giving any regard to the civilians who have done nothing to get involved in this, and yet they're dying, their children are dying, being injured, their homes are destroyed. I just don't ever think that the answer to violence and hate is more killing.
Alex, we just thought exactly the same about Iraq. So a decade ago, over a million around innocent civilians died. And what do we get from that? We got increased terrorism in the area. It's a fuel for terrorism.
So what's the point of the bombing Syria then? Why is it happening?
It's a gesture to support our allies. David Cameron can sit on his little table with all the other powerful white men. ISIS stronghold of Raqqa in Syria also has 500,000 innocent civilians living there, and under 2,000 of those are ISIS militants. You're not going to drop drones, you're not going to drop bombs, and they're not going to fly around until they find a member of ISIS. They're going to kill innocent people. And there's photos that are circulating now of all the people that have died. It's so stupid. Every member of parliament that voted for that government motion was publicly and officially accepting responsibility for the deaths of innocent people. We have homes, we have families to go home to, and I don't like how the members of the House of Commons who have homes, who have families to come home to, who have high wages, can just dictate the lives of the 500,000 innocent people living in Raqqa in Syria. Where's their say?
Hoi man, I'm here because this is a united stand in Bristol. Bombing Syria is really bad. It's a really bad idea from the government. World War III is the consequence. It won't stop. The Syrians will see the West as being evil. Therefore, they don't want to go to the West for help.
You're not gonna look up and see all these Western planes dropping bombs in your homes, killing your relatives, and you're gonna think, oh look, these guys are saving me.
Yeah, exactly.
In fact, if ISIS come along and say, hey look at these guys. They're killing you. They're killing your children. They're killing your parents. They're killing your families. You're not going to support them, are you? You're going to be radicalised and you're going to join ISIS. It's doing nothing. It's not solving the problem. You look what happened in Iraq. 1 million innocent people died. And what happened? It was pre-9/11. You probably had around 200 odd terrorists living in the mountains, no threat to everyone. After the threat in Iraq, you had over 100,000. ISIS was born just months after Bush's decision to invade Iraq. It was Bush's baby. It's not going to work. This bombing doesn't work. It's immoral and it's not justifiable, but it also doesn't work.
Increase the peace! Increase the peace! Increase the peace! Increase the peace!
Adam, and I just completely disagree with the fact that bombing Syria is a solution to terrorism. If you're against refugees, if you're against these families, if you vote for bombing them, you're essentially turning them over to the other side.
It's to do with oil. Like, Iraq was to do with oil. They talk about, oh, Iraq had these weapons of mass destruction. India had nuclear weapons, but they don't have oil, so they weren't avoided. What I don't understand is, how can we have cuts on mental health? Why don't we have money to take in refugees, but we have money to bomb them? It's like, I don't get that.
It's like they don't understand that bombing the country will, like, inevitably send more people over here as refugees and migrants and people who are trying to escape what we're doing, and then denying them access and saying how it's such a big problem and they should all go home. It's just like, it's just the pinnacle of hypocrisy is what it is. They can't consider that what they're doing is wrong, and, like, the implications of, like, suffering that they're causing. People like us need to oppose support for, like, bombing this country, because otherwise we're just as bad as the people who are piloting the planes and dropping the bombs.
We're living under the rule of a man who used to burn £50 notes in front of homeless people.
And he says he's got, like, the popular vote, but he was voted by 24% of the eligible voting population. But they had 51% of the seats and 100% of the power. That's not a democracy. It's really shameful. It's embarrassing that
people our age are, like, thinking how wrong this is, and then people in charge of the country that, you know.
People just don't realise that they have to go out and vote. Otherwise, we have a situation like we do now, where a very small minority of the country has voted for a party that's so damaging. It's like this issue, but also the NHS, education.
And we've also got the mayor candidate, Mr Saville. Would you like to explain why you're here? You're not just here to sell chai, I'd imagine.
No, I'm selling a bit of chai tonight, just for people. 20% of the takings are going to the Calais Refugee Fund. My personal take on it is similar to what Jeremy Corbyn's been saying in the media recently about eventually you have to come to some kind of negotiation and talk about, you know, you can't just bomb forever. Well, perhaps you can, perhaps that is what's going on. But eventually you do need to have a negotiation. Why not start with a negotiation rather than, you know, waiting till afterwards? It largely down to the military industrial complex that does operate in Bristol as well. You know, it's big money.
That was Paul Saville, mayor candidate there, ending that Vox Pop from Wednesday evening's protest on College Green and a march up and down Park Street around the Triangle, organised by students, pupils actually. Martin, what do you make of the comments there?
Well, I was very, very encouraged by the wisdom and common sense of these young people. Cut through a lot of the nonsense that were being fed in the media. I mean, one of the things that most irritated me last week was George Osborne saying that now we are bombing Syria, Britain has got its mojo back, whatever that means. We're all supposed to be standing tall because the RAF have carried out one bombing raid on an already dismantled Iraq oil facility in the ISIS-controlled region of Iraq, of Syria. And these young people have just seen through all of that. Not only have they seen through it, they've also taken action. And they are actually, I'm very proud of all of them. I'm very impressed with the sort of things they were saying.
What about this? One of the points that's been made several times there was this whole thing of this is actually going to help recruitment for ISIS. Do you think that ISIS really want the bombing?
Well, I think what they're probably missing out on this is what's being said in the Middle East, which is that ISIS is in fact a creation of the Gulf
states. Well, yes, let's just forget that for a minute. But what is it going to help recruitment? I would imagine, I mean, you know, maybe we can compare it to the situation in Northern Ireland, for example, as to when there are attacks on civilians and what were, I suppose, in those days were sectarian attacks in Northern Ireland. This, I'm right in thinking that actually the IRA found that there were queues of people queuing up to join them.
Well, you could compare it, for example, to the bombing of Cambodia. in the 1970s, which before the Khmer Rouge were a minor sect in Cambodian political terms. They didn't have much influence. They were a tiny group. But after you'd had indiscriminate bombing of the civilian population of Cambodia, which went on for several years by the Americans, without, in fact, telling the American people what they were
doing.
Well,
without telling Congress. As I remember, this was something cooked up by Kissinger and one of the top generals on board one of the, like, Air Force One of its day. You know, they were sitting on a plane and decided, right, we're going to do this. Yeah. And they didn't ask anybody.
They just did it. But, of course, these massive civilian casualties caused by the bombing of Cambodia led the Khmer Rouge to power in Cambodia eventually and to a huge massacre of people who were their political opponents. You can see that ISIS welcome martyrdom, or at least that's what the official propaganda says. But I will come back to my initial point. What the Russians and the Iranians are accusing the West of doing is pretending to bomb ISIS, and in actual fact not bombing them, not properly, because they're actually using them as a means to destabilise both Syria, Iraq and Iran. That's the actual position on the ground.
Well, that was all the way from Damascus to Bristol there. Bristol, local story, but also international. But staying with Bristol, Bristol devolution. We won't create the Avon, recreate the Avon, promises the government. This is in the Bristol Post earlier this week. As cities across the country get devolution deals, including Manchester, Liverpool and the West Midlands, it's difficult to envisage how a deal to grant Bristol and the West of England more controls will work with the councils in the region, yet come to any consensus. There are fears the councils of South Gloucestershire, North Somerset and Bath and North East Somerset adopting a metro mayor, thought to be a prerequisite to any devolution deal, would be mean giving added authority to Bristol on issues such as transport and business growth. Tory South Gloucestershire MP Chris Skidmore, who we've repeatedly invited on to this show, but he's declined, he's Mr. Osborne's right-hand man now. He's already said putting the region under Bristol's control would be counterintuitive, but keen the region doesn't miss out altogether. So this is a little bit like the attempt to merge police authorities, Martin. I mean, that's actually happened now in Scotland, where you've got one authority for the whole of Scotland. It looks like this is what they're trying to do with North Somerset, South Gloucestershire and Bristol here.
Well, it comes back to the contradictions in the concept of devolution, doesn't it? I mean, what's being proposed here is to centralise power at a higher level than we have at the minute, so it won't be just Bristol City and the local authorities, it'll be a higher level thing, but then power from central government would devolve to this higher level authority. But that means that South Gloss, for example, the reason why the areas around Bristol aren't happy about this is that Bristol has got a much more radical political tradition than the surrounding countryside.
It's got more Labour MPs.
We've got Labour MPs here, we've got more Green voters here, and if Bristol became in charge of the general region, they would the Tory North Somerset Council would feel that they were losing out. And it's the contradictions in these devolution plans are clear.
It sounds like what you're saying is it's not actually really devolution at all, it's more centralisation of power.
Well, it is in one way. I mean, you could say that you're going to create one super authority to cover the Bristol City region, and that will be then devolved power from central government, but it means centralising power in the region. Now, there is actually a strong case for having strong regional government like that. It's the kind of thing that goes on in Germany, for example. The Länder in Germany have considerable powers, and there's a lot to be said for it. But, of course, from a Bristol point of view, where we've got a more radical political tradition, we might find ourselves swamped by a load of Tories and Green wellies, which might make us a bit upset if we were merged with them.
It all sounds like we're going down a bit more of almost like a feudal road with power concentrated into fewer people's individual hands, not in lots of councillors, with just the mayors having a lot of the power.
Indeed.
And actually less of them right across the
country.
Indeed.
So when we're talking about devolution, we're actually talking about centralisation of local power. And of course the real problem is that in actual fact the way Britain runs is that virtually everything is decided in the centre, and local authorities, whether they're based in Bristol, South Gloss or anywhere else, have a very, very limited role. and it's been that way ever since the reforms, so-called, of the 1980s, and the centralisation of power during the Thatcher era.
OK, let's go to Wednesday in Prime Minister's Questions this week, where I don't know what you made of this, Martin, but David Cameron again, as week before, not doing a Prime Minister's Questions. Last week it was because of the Syria debate. This week he's off in Poland. And do you think it's a good idea for the Labour Party, the opposition, to play into his hands and have somebody else instead of Jeremy Corbyn standing up? Because it's, I mean, certainly I can remember not too many years ago, there used to be two Prime Minister's Questions a week, and lo and behold, it'd be very difficult for a Prime Minister to miss either of them. But now, quite a lot of them are skipped, and it looks like, I'm not even sure if there's a PMQs next week.
Well, it's hard for me to comment because I don't know what the arrangements are within the Labour Party or between the opposition and the government about it. Maybe we should just have a listen to what happened and then make our minds up.
Mr. Speaker, I see that the Prime Minister can't be with us to answer questions today because he's visiting Poland and Romania on the latest leg of his seemingly endless European renegotiation tour. Mr. Speaker, he's been jetting all over the place. No wonder we had to buy him his own aeroplane. Chancellor, tell us, please, how's it all going?
Chancellor! Well, the good news is... Well, the good news is we have a party leader who's respected abroad. Minister is in Central and Eastern Europe because we're fighting for a better deal for Britain, something that never would have happened if there had been a Labour government.
Now, I mean, this, how's it all going? Not much of a question, really, was it?
Well, so
a lot of fun, but it's, you know...
This is Angela Eagle, isn't
it? Yes, that's right, yes. Angela Eagle,
well, I mean, what she means
German
is how's
Corbyn.
It all going in terms of his renegotiation of Britain's relationship with Europe? So, in other words, she knows that there are big divisions in the Tory party.
Well, as I remember it, back in May...
When David Cameron
said that he was going to renegotiate, that he was told pretty much immediately by Hollande and Merkel, no way. But he's still trying.
Yes, well, I mean, he's kind of locked himself into that, hasn't he, really? What's likely to happen is he's not going to get anything from the rest of the European Union, which is at all acceptable to his own right-wing rump. And frankly, even if he did get some concessions, they wouldn't like it, because they're determined to take Britain out of the European Union come what may. So it's an attempt by Angela Eagle, who in fact voted for bombing Syria. So there's splits in the Labour Party here. And it's, a fairly creditable attempt to, in those circumstances, to turn the fire on the government and say, well, hang on, you're split as well, because you can't agree about what you need to do about Europe. And, it's a fair comment.
Staying with Prime Minister's Questions, this week, Donald Trump came up.
Tasmina Ahmed Sheikh.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It's my understanding that the Home Secretary has banned 84 hate preachers from entering the UK. Will the government lead by example in considering making Mr. Donald Trump number 85?
Chancellor.
Look, I think the best way to confront the views of someone like Donald Trump is to engage in a robust democratic argument with him about why he is profoundly wrong about the contribution of American Muslims and indeed British Muslims. And that is the best way to deal with Donald Trump and his views, rather than trying to ban presidential candidates.
What do you make there of the comparison with the presidential candidate for the Republican Party, Donald Trump there, Martin, who's been calling for the banning of all new Muslims that want to come to the United States?
Well, what can you just rephrase the question? I'm not sure what the question is. Are you asking about Donald Trump, or are you asking about...
No, I mean, she's comparing him to hate preachers. She's saying 84 hate preachers have been banned from coming to Britain. Should he be banned too?
Well, I think she's trying to make political capital out of whoever it was. I've forgotten who it was. I don't think it's feasible to ban Donald Trump from coming to Britain. And I hate to say it, but maybe George Osborne has his point there, which is the only way to deal with Donald Trump is to argue with him and make him appear the idiot that he actually is.
And why not do the same with hate preachers then?
Well, some people are caught. I mean, Donald Trump has called for the banning of Muslims to be allowed into the US as an immigration control. Reprehensible. But it's not calling for them to be killed, for example, or demanding that they be executed, etc. That is hate speech, and that is banned, quite rightly. You can have robust opinions about all sorts of things, but you can't call for physical violence against your political opponents.
What do you make of this, Mr. Trump, then? Because I noticed, I heard Selena Scott, I think it was yesterday, on the Radio 5 Live, talking about this whole incident with this 90-year-old woman he's been bullying up in Edinburgh, Aberdeen, who's refusing to sell her house because he wants to buy it to finish off his nice multi-million-pound golf course. And also a local farmer who he says lives like a pig.
Well, Donald Trump is a phenomenon, isn't he? He's getting considerable coverage and support in the United States, which is very worrying, because many of his rather crackpot views are held by many people. Although from the establishment's point of view, him pointing out that President Putin's got it right over Syria, for example, and various other things, he's a bit like Nigel Farage. He tells the truth sometimes without even realising the implications of what he's actually saying. But what makes me laugh about Trump is that he has this reputation for being a multimillionaire, and he said, you know, I've got my own money, so I don't need to take any money from anybody else to run for president. And when I didn't run for president, I was able to buy various, you know, I was able to buy various politicians. Hillary Clinton, I gave her some money, and I made her come to my wedding, and she had to come to my wedding because I'd given her the money. So he's being absolutely straight up about.
Well, what about really the okay? What about the support he's had from the Ku Klux Klan, for example, and also from neo-Nazi leaders who are saying that. He is the real deal, this Donald Trump. Also note that one of his ex-partners said he used to keep a copy of Mein Kampf by his bedside.
Well, Donald Trump, before I didn't quite make the point, Donald Trump has been bankrupted 3 or 4 times. So in other words, the idea that he's some kind of financial genius is laughable. He's basically a chancer who has been bankrupted several times. He's a property speculator who's managed to claw his way back into public view, even though he's been bankrupted. Clearly, there's lots of very unsavoury people coming out of the woodwork to suggest that he's saying the right thing.
Well, when William Daniel Johnson, chairman of the openly white supremacist American Freedom Party, neo-Nazis, say this is a unique phenomenon in modern politics, it's a throwback to a previous era. What previous era do you think he's talking about?
Well, he's talking about the racist previous history of the United States of America, which was, you know, till well into the 20th century, an openly and avowedly racist society. Woodrow Wilson, who I've just been reading about in a book about the First World War, remembered by fondly as a kind of liberal in favour of self-determination, was also an out-and-out avowed racist as a Democrat. And that was all perfectly normal at the beginning of the 20th century in the US. That's what we're talking about.
Maybe introducing extreme right-wing racism into the political mainstream. That might be Donald Trump's great achievement.
He's giving encouragement to all of that. But I would actually point out to Donald Trump and others, not that he's listening to us, if the US does take a turn in that direction, then I think it's definitely the case that Britain should leave NATO. We don't want to be run by people like that, do we, folks?
We'll be talking a bit more about NATO in the second half, but another story now. Britain should lead the way on genetically engineered babies, says the government's chief scientific advisor. Britain has the science and regulation to be able to lead the way in genetic engineering, Sir Mark Walport has said. Last week, more than 150 scientists and campaigners called for a worldwide ban on this practice, claiming it could irrevocably alter the human species and lead to a world where inequality, discrimination were inscribed into the human genome. But at a conference in London this week, Sir Mark Walport, who advises the government on scientific matters, said he believed there were circumstances in which the genetic editing of human embryos would be acceptable and that Britain should lead the way.
Well, this is a very tricky one, isn't it? I'm not in favour of the general, you know, just because we can do it, we should do it. But on the other hand, it's inconsistent then to I mean, we do intervene with in pre-birth situations with children in the womb and decide to abort them if they've got serious illnesses and so on. So,
but this is designer babies.
Designer babies is unacceptable. But on the other hand,
what he's saying here.
Yeah, but I mean, you can't.
And obviously, only rich people would be able to afford such a thing.
Indeed. So, but you may want. We do already intervene medically before birth in certain circumstances. Any intervention must be very, very circumspect, though. You don't want to get a situation where people are having designer babies, any intervention has got to be within the context where, basically, we're not going to build, try and create better humans through intervention at this level. We're just trying to.
Well, that's effectively what he's saying. If you want to design a baby, you want to pick and choose what kind of characteristics that baby's going to have. This sounds to me a bit like a kind of picking up where the Nazis left off in eugenics.
Well, that's unacceptable. And therefore, we
where do you draw the line then?
Well, where do you draw the line? I think there needs to be a debate about that. It needs to be an informed debate. We need to hear from people who know about the technologies and the biology of all of this to explain us what the options are, so that we can then make an informed choice about what's a reasonable intervention and what is not. And we need to talk about it a lot more than we have.
Well, one of the things that has been talked about a bit this week, although not much in detail, is the UN's Paris talks on climate change. Before we hear from Patrick Chalmers, who used to work for Reuters at the time of the Kyoto summit, Martin, what's your thoughts about if any progress is being made on climate talks and what the real agendas are in Paris?
Well, I understand that they are talking through the night tonight and that something may be signed tomorrow. I think that climate change ends up being a kind of issue where we're kind of critiquing the whole of modern society by critiquing climate change. And particularly on the green side of
politics. But it's not the whole society, it's energy use mainly.
Well, yes, it's energy use and so on. Now, I think that it's irrefutable, even if you don't believe in climate change, it's irrefutable that we are using up the world's resources too fast, in the wrong way, to do the wrong things, to protect the privileged lifestyles of a tiny minority of the world's population. That has got to change under any circumstances. And whatever your views about climate change, some steps have to be taken to change the way in which we use energy and resources. And in a way, the climate change debate then becomes a kind of cipher for that wider question that needs to be addressed.
Well, as I said, Patrick Chalmers was a journalist for Reuters at the original Kyoto summit, where which really started this whole process many years ago. And he's since left journalism, and he's written a book called Fraudcast News. And this interview I did with him for the Dialect programme, which used to be broadcast here on BCFM, isn't anymore, but you can get it online at www.dialectradio.co.uk. So let's have a listen to see what Patrick Chalmers, author of Fraudcast News, had to say about this COP21 talks in Paris.
If you cover environmental issues, let's leave aside all of the other ones, you look at the metrics of climate change, you look at the metrics of species loss, you look at the metrics of resource use, any one of those is pretty alarming. And so if you have children and grandchildren, or you have people who are dear to you who have children or grandchildren, then there is certainly the wherewithal to be alarmed. Do you want to live in a perpetual state of alarm? I don't think there's any point. This fellow interviewed by Democracy Now! From the Tyndall Centre was talking along the lines of, I haven't got much hope in this process, but what else can I do? And so that is the approach that I take myself, and I would encourage other people to take, which is that things don't look good at all, but, you know, what do you want to do in the face of that? Do you want to make all your friends miserable, or do you want to think what needs to be done and what can I personally do to try and help? That's the choice that I make personally. Obviously, people will make their own choices, but it's the only way forward as far as I can see without sort of going stark raving bonkers.
Well, I mean, that reiterates pretty much what I said, which is that it's not a very satisfactory situation or a satisfactory process, but at least we're talking about the issues and some progress might be made. I must say that I'm absolutely opposed to the whole policy of cap and trade, because what's been happening is that certain people have been pushing the idea that you could trade carbon credits. And it's actually basically a whole hedge fund idea, so that countries would get carbon credits and then they could trade those credits. And that, of course, the traders would be the ones who would be making a killing on that. If you are serious about reducing energy use, I won't say climate gases, I'll just say energy use, then actually you've got to have a plan. The kind of plan that we had in both world wars. Governments sat down and said, right, how much coal have we got? How much oil have we got? How much do we need? How much can we use? How are we going to ration it? That is a rational way to approach any kind of issue like this. Now, even if you don't believe in man-made global warming, you've still got to make a plan for the rational use of energy resources going forward, because we can't have a situation where a tiny minority of the world's population, the 1% who live in the wealthy countries, who have extravagant lifestyles, should be able to use up resources which ought to be the general patrimony of humanity in general.
Isn't the main problem here that, in a way, it's seen as the developed world lording it over the developing world, saying, well, we've been for decades, even hundreds of years, polluting, but we don't want you to, as you start to develop?
Indeed, the only way that this has been made to stick is if the developed countries with the higher lifestyles have to agree to cut their lifestyles so that others can develop their lifestyles without ruining the planet. Now, whether you believe in man-made global warming or not, that is the issue of our era. Are we going to allow the distorted priorities of crony capitalism in the West to destroy the future for the rest of humanity? That's the real choice we face.
And apparently the talks are not going to finish until tomorrow, but they are notorious for overrunning. So let's hope they can bang heads together over in Paris over this. Next story, your car spying on you. Warnings over how much personal information it might hold. From location and driving styles to where you have been, the data is not regulated. Thousands of Europe's drivers are being spied upon by their cars. And from 2018, every vehicle sold could alert advisors, advertisers and others to their habits and locations. A European motoring organisation is warning. The Federation of International de l'Automobile, FIA, a Brussels-based consumer body representing 111 motoring and touring clubs, I guess that's like the AA and RAC, and 38 million drivers, that's you folks, has launched a campaign urging greater safeguards for the use of information on drivers gathered by tracking devices that are becoming compulsory in all new cars. A survey of 12,000 people in 12 countries, including Britain, found 90% want to own their own car data. Now, Martin, what we're looking at here is basically, if you've got a lot of money to spend and you spend a lot of money and you're rich, your car will be transmitting that data out. And as you drive around, we're even talking about things like active, smart kind of advertising hoardings changing so that the highest bidder can get to you to see their advert.
Well, it's not just about cars, this, is it? All sorts of electronic technology. We were talking about smart metering at one stage on this programme, and that, of course, is monitored from the outside. A smart meter in your house that decides to tell you, you know, that's linked to the internet means that it can be hacked. And, of course, the Michael Hastings, the journalist in the US, it looks as if he was assassinated by people hacking into the onboard computer on his car and then driving him into a lamppost at 90 miles an hour. All very worrying, isn't it? I mean, the fact, if you've got an old banger like mine, nobody can crash it except yourself.
But not if you've got a modern car. Yeah, though as you connect onto the internet connects into you and starts harvesting your data and making a massive profile for various different organisations, not least of which the intelligence services, that can then they can sell it, market it, do what they want with it, or steal it. Another slight motoring story, I suppose, here is a Glasgow bin lorry crash. The driver lied about his health history, the inquiry finds. An inquiry into the Glasgow bin lorry crash left six people dead and 15 injured about this time last year. It's concluded the driver repeatedly lied to gain and retain jobs and licences. He deliberately and systematically concealed nearly 40 years of ill health, effectively blaming Clark for the crash. He said it would be avoided if Clark had told the truth about the previous blackout and his health record to doctors. Now, what they're saying is better health checks, but what about just prosecuting this guy and prosecuting anybody that lies and then about their ability to drive and then causes injuries like this and deaths?
Well, he's clearly in the wrong if he's not given the relevant information to the people who are employing him. But I would point out that if you are on benefits in this country and you are on the sickness benefit or unemployment benefit, you are put under enormous pressure to take any job under any circumstances. And that may well be the case with this gentleman here. If he was on benefits for any time at all, he will have been put under enormous pressure to take any kind of job.
A lot of people out there have lied, haven't they, to get their jobs?
Yep,
and that's because they're so desperate.
Because in actual fact, your life is made a misery unless you take some job, any job. And a driving job is an obvious thing to go for, because as long as you've got a driving licence, you're eligible for that job. Of course, he shouldn't have done that. And if we had a less punitive benefit system, maybe he wouldn't have done
that. Okay, finally, Caroline Lucas, Green Party MP from Brighton, resigns from Stop the War after finding herself unable to support the group's recent positions. But she's not very clear about this, but it certainly seems as if what she's objected to is a post on the Stop the War website, which was talking about Paris and the French reaping the whirlwind of foreign policy in the Middle East.
Well, I think this is...
And that post has now been removed, I believe.
Well, this is extremely regrettable. Stop the War is a broad-based organisation, and people have got a variety of views within it. It's a perfectly legitimate comment to suggest that France has reaped the whirlwind in Paris. I don't think it's true. I think what happened in Paris was a false flag, probably by NATO or the Israelis. But let's just say assume for the moment that the official story is correct, and that ISIS did it as revenge for France bombing its positions in Syria.
There certainly does seem
to... Certainly It's an obvious point.
There certainly seems to be a big push amongst the police to call things terror attacks. We had one in Leytonstone at the tube station last weekend, didn't we? It turned out that the guy was just basically mentally ill and a victim of the Conservative mental health cuts.
Well, that's true. And also, of course, when we're talking about these terror attacks, many of the perpetrators turn out to have drug, alcohol and mental health issues. And these are exactly the people that have been recruited into these groups. The FBI have created over 150 different terrorist operations inside the United States, each one of which was entirely concocted by the FBI. They went out and found people with drug, alcohol and mental health issues, persuaded them to participate in these various campaigns, and then busted them and said, oh, look, we've got some terrorists here. Completely wrong. Because if you've got real terrorists out there, that provides cover for them, because you're actually finding lots of pretend terrorists. And of course, the real problem is that these pretend terrorists are then, like what's happened in San Bernardino, looks fairly clear. There were three white shooters.
Hold fire, Martin. We'll talk about that after the Murdoch News at 6. That was Martin Summers, I'm afraid. Our guest this week was supposed to be Tory group leader Mark Weston, but he's lost his voice today and couldn't find a last-minute replacement. After the news, some experts on the Middle East and the war on terrorism.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.